We're, you know, keen investigators, and this sense is something is wrong here.
But wait, didn't the 8.5-year-old child pick the father out of a lineup?
Well, as a 22-year veteran of the FBI, I always love it when somebody up above, somebody in administration says, "You're nuts, get out of here."
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is your host, Jim Clementi, with my co-host, Francie Hakes. How you doing, Francie?
Good. Hi, Jim.
Great to have you here. And today we have another special guest, John Tanza, who's a retired FBI supervisory special agent, and he's here today to tell us about his best case, worst case. How you doing, John?
Not too bad today.
Good. Well, it's great to have you. We appreciate you coming out. So tell us, where were you stationed while you were in the FBI, and how long were you in?
Well, I started my career in Monroe, Louisiana. That was my first office. Wow. In 1987. I spent 10 years in that small little office. It was a three-man resident agency, and really kind of out of my comfort zone since I came from New York. I was used to a big city and a lot of different things, and Louisiana was a definite change of pace and culture.
Oh, yeah.
From there, I was transferred up to Cleveland, Ohio, while I was active in a long-term undercover case involving police corruption up in Cleveland.
Wow.
And I spent 10 years there.
Okay, and did you go back to headquarters at any point?
Yeah, from Cleveland, I went back to FBI headquarters for a period of time as a supervisor in the undercover and sensitive operations unit there.
How long were you there?
2 years.
Yeah, what years were those?
That would have been in like 2003.
Yeah, I was undercover myself for a few years, but that was 1989 through 91. I was a broker on the commodities exchange in New York City, on the floor of the exchange.
That's good. I couldn't do all that math and calculations. All my undercover stuff was with Italian wise guys who barely can count to 10.
Okay, well, hopefully at some point we'll be able to talk to you about some of those cases.
Sure.
So then you, after FBI headquarters, where did you go?
I came back to Cleveland. Worked another undercover case for about 2 years and then transferred to Las Vegas, Nevada, where I ended up spending 10 years and retiring out of.
Wow, John, that's a great geographic mix from New York to Louisiana to Cleveland to D.C. to Vegas. That's everything pretty much.
Yes, it covers pretty much of the continent and a lot of different cultures and habitats and things like that.
Well, let's jump right in and tell us what kind of case do you want to talk to us about as your best case?
Well, one of my best cases, or at least the one that I feel that I gained something from both experience and a positive outcome, was actually very early on in my career in 1998. I was only in the Bureau for about 2 years in Louisiana. And we were working a serial kidnapper out of Shreveport, Louisiana. Being a new agent, I wasn't obviously leading the case or handling any of the finesse that had to be done with the local law enforcement and things like that. I was just basically an extra hand, an extra body that I was brought over to kind of assist with ancillary type duties, you know, kind of like the the sweeping up of whatever other things they needed done.
Okay.
Well, that sounds interesting. Serial kidnapping. I'm intrigued. I, of course, know about serial killing, serial child abusing, but serial kidnapping is a bit of a new one on me. Can you tell us a little more about how the case came into you?
Yeah, the subject had kidnapped a little boy and raped him. He was 8 years old and left him alive. A few days later, he attempted to kidnap a young female, was unsuccessful. And then the third attempt, he kidnapped a young female about 7 years old, drove her over into Texas, which gave us the jurisdiction because he crossed state lines with her. He raped her and then dumped her off of a bridge, assuming she was dead, but she didn't die.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty horrible.
And yeah, the Bureau was brought in because of the interstate aspects of it and the fact that it was a child. It became a very high-profile type investigation that a number of agents, probably we had about 50 to 60, responding to work with the local state police and local law enforcement in Shreveport, Louisiana, trying to hunt this individual down.
Got it. So you got called in sort of as a utility man and went to work. So tell us something about how you experienced this investigation.
Well, myself and another young agent were given a task. Apparently, a parent had called in and said that they had their daughter going down to a vending machine in a hotel, and a gentleman tried to help her with getting some candy out, and they became suspicious of that. The gentleman left and nothing happened, but they got the plate number of the vehicle. So it was my assignment to just go track that plate number down. While that was happening, they had a primary suspect that they believed had done this. They had our surveillance teams on him 24 hours a day. They had wiretaps on his phone. He was 55 years old. They believed this was the guy. The little girl who survived identified him out of a photo lineup. So they were pretty sure they had him. They were just waiting for the rest of the evidence and forensics to come back before they were able to issue a warrant for him.
So we were kind of
just doing cleanup.
So this is the guy that it was suspected in the kidnap and rape of the 8-year-old boy, and then the attempted abduction of another girl, and then the actual abduction of a third child.
Yes.
And do you know, John, like why or what was the investigative work that resulted in identifying a single suspect in all of those cases? Do you know?
I think his vehicle was in the vicinity of the little girl when she was kidnapped. Someone had gotten a plate number off the vehicle. They didn't know if it was, the vehicle that had the girl in it, but it was presumed it was. And then when they started doing some further details and research on the individual, the male, they found out that he had a record of some domestic abuse, some violence, and things like that. So the supervisor, the special agent in charge, and the assistant special agent in charge were there in Shreveport, and they determined that he was his best candidate, the best subject to believe had did it.
Okay, so what did they do to go about trying to prove that?
Well, they were working on the forensics. The DNA is not what it is today, but they were trying to get DNA samples. They were trying to get fingerprints. They were processing his car. They had gotten surreptitious search warrants to enter his home to look for other evidence, trophies he may have kept from the girl, and things like that. So they were very, very aggressively pursuing him as the main subject. Again, 24-hour surveillance, wiretaps, and the little girl identified him out of a photo lineup.
Yeah, wow. That's incredible.
And she was how old?
She was 8 and a half, I believe.
Wow. Wow. That's pretty amazing. All right, so... And now they have him under surveillance, and they're searching. What was the outcome of that?
Well, they sent myself and my partner out to just check this plate number out that this couple had gotten from a guy that tried helping their daughter from a candy machine. And so we went to the residence. We tracked it down, went to the residence, And when we got there, there was a young man there, name of James, and we asked him where his father was, because that's where the car came back to. And his father was 55 years old, too, about the same age as the primary suspect. He said his father was out of town. He was busy working on a job for a major company, and he wouldn't be back for a couple days.
So did that mean, John, that he could not have been the person who helped the child with the candy machine?
No, he was in town at that time.
Okay.
So the son was maybe covering for him or didn't know the father was in town?
No, the son just, you know, was answering our questions. And then the son, James, says to us, could you guys comment on a case that's been in the newspapers? Now, James is 27 years old, and we didn't know, you know, what he was talking about. So we said, well, what kind of case, James? And he said, oh, a drug case, this major drug thing that happened. And myself and my partner looked at each other and said, no, we really, you know, we're not from here. We're from Monroe. We really don't know. So we talked to James a little bit and said, where have you been? You know, what's going on? You know, we want to make small talk. He said, oh, I've been away studying at college for the last few years. And I just came back, moved back in with my father, studying computer science. I said, okay. As we were leaving, James said to us, one more thing. And yes, what is it? What can we help you with? We just want your father to call us when he gets back. He says, well, you know, I've got to cut the grass and I've got to put gas in the lawnmower. Thanks, guys. I just want to just mention that.
Well, that's weird.
Odd. Very odd.
Very odd. Being young, aggressive agents, we looked at each other saying,
so what'd you do?
So we went back to the main office where the task force was assembled, and we walked in. And we had both said to each other on the way there that this is the guy that did it. This is the guy that did it all.
You thought James was the offender, not his father?
Correct. Just because of the quirkiness, the weirdness. It was just something that caught us that said, you know, this is the guy.
But wait, didn't the 8.5-year-old child pick the father out of a lineup?
Not the father. Another suspect.
No, it picked out the main subject, yes.
Oh, the different subject. Okay, all right.
Okay, so where are we now? What did you do when you got back there?
We went to the assistant special agent in charge, the head of the task force, and said, we've got the guy. We know who did it. And
that's a pretty bold statement there, John. How did you back that up?
Well, my partner went and ran the son's criminal history.
Okay.
And he wasn't in college. He was doing 7 years in prison for raping two young female girls.
Okay, well, that's what I would might call a clue.
And I would say, wow, John, good instincts.
Except the assistant special agent in charge said, you guys are nuts. Get out of here.
Was that before or after you ran the criminal history?
That was after.
Really?
He said, you guys are, you know, this is not the guy, we got the guy.
Well, as a 22-year veteran of the FBI, I always love it when somebody up above, somebody in administration says, you're nuts, get out of here. Because, you know, obviously that means you're doing your job. So tell us what happened next.
Well, a very smart supervisor looked at us and took us aside and says, follow this, keep tracking it, don't say anything and disappear.
Yeah, in other words, work under the radar, right?
Right.
Okay, so what did you do next?
We went to the local police department, and who was working the case also, and said, we need a photo lineup of the father, his father. And we want a photo lineup of the son, put together a very difficult photo lineup to show the boy that had been kidnapped.
Okay.
And we went and showed the boy the pictures, and he picked out James from the photo lineup.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, that's a good clue, too.
Clue number two,
going in the right direction. And then what happened? This is an 8-year-old boy, though, right?
Right. Okay. 8-year-old boy. Well, he was kidnapped from a playground where there were a number of other young boys there and girls. So we started going to meet each one of them. There were six of them, and five of the six picked James out of the photo lineup.
Wow.
Just out of curiosity, did the sixth pick someone different or just fail to ID anybody?
Just failed to ID anybody.
Oh, much better. Okay.
Okay. She's always thinking like a prosecutor, but
sorry. Can't help it.
But this is a great example of what you know people call shoe leather work or gumshoe work. You're actually on the streets doing work, verifying, corroborating your gut instinct. And we'll talk a little bit about that as well. But what was the next thing that happened?
Well, we went back, obviously, and told the supervisor that had told us to continue working on this, what we had gotten, and that the boy ID'd James as the perpetrator. And we checked with behavioral science in the middle of this because I had watched TV and I knew that we're supposed to check with behavioral science, I think.
There you go.
And
did you watch Criminal Minds, by the way?
I did.
All right, great.
It wasn't on back then, but I think it was the FBI with Effer Zimbalist Jr.
Okay.
Behavioral science made a very interesting point. They said that a serial rapist slash kidnapper like this, it would manifest much earlier on than this 55-year-old suspect that they had. He had no history of rape or kidnapping or child abuse or anything like that. He had some domestic abuse, but not child abuse. So with behavioral science, the manifestation of this behavior was obvious in James because he had already done 7 years in jail from a previous assault on two young girls.
Right.
So it fit into their profile.
Gotcha. So that's now three. Well, actually, you have five other kids. So now you have six confirming IDs from the photo lineup. You have your gut instinct on that day. You have his criminal history, and you have the behavioral profile saying that it's consistent with James. What do you do next?
Well, we thought we had enough, so we went and saw the assistant special agent in charge. The supervisor was with us, and we gave him all that we had, and he basically said...
Wait. Before you get there, can you just tell me how it went that when you went to the ASAC with your supervisor and said, we didn't follow your orders, we went ahead and did work. Did he flip out a little bit? Was he pissed off?
He had that look on his face, that supervisor would get sometimes, like, when this is done, I'll take care of you too.
Right.
But no, he was at least receptive. It's a little bit. But he said, well, good work. You've got the guy that kidnapped the boy. But we've got the one that kidnapped and dumped the girl off of the bridge.
Wow.
So talk about confirmation bias. That guy had settled on a suspect, and he didn't care what other evidence was going to come in. He wasn't going to be dissuaded from his view of how the case was supposed to go.
Okay, so that sounds like he's not going to actually even try to see if the suspect that you identified, James, was at all responsible for the attempted and the abduction of the 8-year-old girl. Did he by any chance believe that was because they were different genders, that the boy picked out James and that James, if he did abduct the boy, would not go after girls?
Yeah, I think that played into it, that the gender issue was an issue. But again, the guy also tried to kidnap the little girl from the vending machine. So we kind of negated that by saying, no, he went after girls too. It was just, it was opportunity. He looked for just victims of opportunity that he was willing to take. But that argument really didn't go over because they were pretty set on who... they were going to arrest and put this on.
Well, you know, of course, he wouldn't know that the Behavioral Analysis Unit would later actually do research on this very topic and find out that there's a high degree of crossover with respect to gender on child abduction cases and child sex crimes cases, which this sounds like it was. And because of that, you should never put blinders on. If somebody is interested sexually in children, the chances of them offending against children of either gender is going to be fairly high. So for all our listeners out there, if you do hear of somebody who has been offending against one gender of a child, children of the opposite gender are not safe with that offender, period. They are not safe.
That's so true, Jim. And you and I were actually talking earlier about a case of mine that proves that perfectly. I prosecuted a grandfather who had sexually assaulted his sister when the child was under 10 and he was a teen. Then his daughter for almost her whole life until she was about 16 or 17. And then his grandson from a very young age until the age of about 10 or 11. So it's absolutely true. Law enforcement can't have that kind of a bias going in to a case like this. And John, I have a question for you. I'm kind of curious. You had said that you were told first to get lost. The ASAC said stop pursuing this avenue. Then you discovered all of these clues that showed James had kidnapped the boy. What was the time? Let's talk a little bit about the time frame and then the rest of the investigation. But first, tell me how long it took for you to go back to the ASAC after he told you to get lost.
Probably 2 days.
Wow. So short. Very, very good work for you.
Yeah.
Very short. It was pretty intense. It was a 24/7 thing. Sleep wasn't important. We had to get this resolved. So we were on it pretty hard.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Well, I want to go back to one thing that you just said, Francie, though, that about that case that we were discussing and the generational nature of it, that this particular offender had offended against three generations of his family members. And the fact is that this is not unusual, that especially in incest cases, the offender can offend against one child, and when that child then has a child of their own, wait all that time, and with no evidence that they've offended against anybody else, but then offend against their grandchild. I mean, that kind of thing is just, I mean, to a lot of people, just, well, what? Why, how could that happen? But I've heard it time and time and time again. So that's another thing our listeners should be careful of. Because just because somebody is now old, an offender is now old, doesn't mean that they won't offend against a grandchild or even a great-grandchild.
That's right. And this offender, when we took him to trial, was about 60. And he had first sexually assaulted his sister when he was 17. Wow. So you're absolutely right.
Well, what I'd like to get into now is talk about how you were able to sort of marshal all your forces and move forward on this case.
Well, behavioral science also had some other information for us, too. They said that the offender probably had some kind of a trigger, that some event or something that happened that triggered behavior to start again if they had stopped for a while. So we put that in our notebooks and wanted to figure out, okay, what started James on this again since he did 7 years in prison? He's been out of the loop. What's triggered him? So
he didn't tell you he was at crime university, did he?
No.
Okay.
The supervisor said, continue on, you know, what you were doing in your investigation, full press, work with the locals. I think we're on to something. And so we did. We set up outside of his house for 24/7 surveillance of James with the locals. So it's about 98 degrees in Shreveport, Louisiana, in the middle of summer. And I'm in a three-piece suit, as was the fashion of the day, sweating profusely.
I hear you, John. I'm a Southern girl myself from Georgia, so I understand that heat and humidity and how difficult that makes everything.
We were out there, and we saw the vehicles were in the driveway from James's house. His father had not returned from out of town yet. So we knew he was in there, but the house was in darkness. I think James pretty much knew we were outside waiting for a search warrant because we couldn't enter the house. We wanted to go in and look for evidence. So it was about 6 hours into this with no water, no food. So I went up to the door of the house and I knocked again. And of course, no one answered. And I said, James, I know you're in there and you have air conditioning and a refrigerator and water and food. Would you mind ordering us a pizza while we sit out here?
John, I have never heard of such a thing.
What?
I was a little, I don't know.
Ballsy?
You were crazy, hungry, thirsty, and hot is what you were.
Correct.
And ballsy. And,
yeah.
And ballsy.
You're from New York, right?
I'm from New York.
There you go.
What can I tell you? I'm Italian, and I'm from New York.
Forget about it.
So I begged him for a while, you know, explained to him how bad it was out here and everything, and it was horrible. And, of course, you know, nothing happened. James didn't get anything. But a phone call comes into the task force, and the caller says he's James and that he's at a nearby bar and he wants to talk to agents because he wants to talk about what he had done.
Wait, is this – I'm confused. Aren't you sitting on his house?
Yes.
Well, he could be lying, by the way, Francie.
Well, I know, but I'm just trying to clarify that.
Or
Jim.
He may not have been in the house. We don't know yet. That's
no,
part of the story.
He was in the house. He was in the house. So what he was doing was trying to lure us away from
yes,
the house.
Yes, he was. A lying suspect. Wow, that's a first.
But our ASAC, Assistant Special Agent in Charge, said, great, guys, get off the house. Go interview him.
I'm sorry, John, I have a quick question about the ASAC. Did he have any actual investigative experience? No,
no he's an ASAC.
That.
He doesn't have to.
Don't answer that.
All right. This is.
I'll leave that one to your own judgment.
All right. But it is a good opportunity to educate the public about what actually happens in the FBI, how you get promoted in the FBI. Unlike in the private world, in the business world, where you typically think that people will get promoted based on merit and experience. In the FBI, that's not the case at all. Once you put in a minimal number of years, like 3 or 4 years, if you want to get promoted, you simply raise your hand. And all you have to do is be willing to move back to headquarters and then move to somebody else, somewhere else and move to another place and like every 18 months or 2 years, go to another office and you will continually be promoted. And That is typically only done by people who only care about the promotion, not about the investigation, not about their families at home that they rip out of schools and move from community to community, but just because they want to get ahead. That's my experience. What about you, John?
I think you said the exact words I always say when people ask you, how do you get promoted in the FBI?
Yeah, well, we both experienced the same bureau then. It's unfortunate. Yes. But anyway, yes, be that as it may, something tells me that you were able to avoid doing what this ASAC wanted you to do in this case.
For the second time.
Yeah, in this case, no, because this was an order, which would have probably got myself as a year and a half, close to 2 year agent, in more serious hot water than I already was in, kind of. So we did. We went to the bar, and I told the supervisor that this guy is not here. He's at the house, and this is all a bad idea, but we're doing it. So we go to the bar, and of course, he's not there. And we go back to the house, and of course, one of the vehicles is gone now.
Wow. I can't believe that. That's terrifying.
Well, but now I'm assuming you have that license plate and a description of the vehicle, and you're going to go look for him, right?
Yes.
And of course, now, sorry, John, now, thanks to the ASAC, you've got a dangerous child sex offender who knows you're sitting on him running around loose with kids.
That would be a true statement.
Wow. So what do you guys do next?
So it's about 3 o'clock in the morning now. So I think I go and shower and change and get ready to get back at it. The next day, about 2 p.m, task force gets a call from a priest. And the priest says, I just heard the confession of an individual who said he had kidnapped a little boy and killed him and kidnapped and raped a little girl and kidnapped her.
Wow.
So now the supervisor and the ASAC are kind of getting like, maybe we know what we're talking about. So they show the photo lineup of the one that I had done with the boy to the little girl, and she IDs James out of the lineup as the one who abducted her.
Wow.
This is a girl who had previously identified a 55-year-old man.
Right.
Interesting.
Wow.
But the girl was severely traumatized. I mean, she had been dropped off of a bridge.
Oh, we totally understand. Yeah, we totally understand.
As a prosecutor now, I'm worried. I'm worried about the case because that is a detail that a defense attorney is going to take an inch and drive a truck a mile wide through.
Of course. But they don't have myself as the prime investigator.
There you go. There you go.
That's right.
All right, so what happens next? I mean, we're like on the edge of our seats here.
So now I'm ordered to go see the priest. They've now started to redirect all the surveillance and all the manpower looking for James versus the guy they had been sitting on. And I go interview the priest, and of course the priest says, hey, this was in a confessional. I can't tell you, anything about who it was or anything else because he confessed.
Okay.
So I explained to him that I was a good Catholic and I was an altar boy, and I understand everything. And I said, Father, if I should show you a picture, if you bless me, then I would know that I too would be saved. And okay. So I held up a picture of James, and he made the sign of the cross.
John, you are the man. I mean, I am absolutely loving this story. It is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure what's going to happen next, but I can tell.
But please do tell us, please.
I can tell our listeners, too, though, that it's really interesting. Jim and I are just sitting here making crazy faces because this is so amazing. I had a case once with priest penitent privilege at issue. And John's absolutely right. The priest could not, should not identify who gave the confession, really any of the details of the confession, because the penitent, not the priest, is the holder of the privilege. So unless there's some waiver, it was given outside the confessional, there was someone, not a priest involved, or it wasn't part of an actual religious confession, then that's pretty solid. And I'm going to be eager to hear, John, whether at the end of all this, the priest took the stand in the case. But don't get there yet. No spoiler alerts. Tell us what happened next,
please.
So now, since all the resources are mustered on our main subject, James, they find out that he's registered at the local college and is taking courses there. So James is a creature of habit. They said, go to the college to see if he's in class. Well, on my way to the college, I picked up my partner because we had been split. And on the way there, they said, we have arrest warrants in hand for him. Arrest him.
Okay.
So we go to the college, and sure enough, James is in class.
Well, you wouldn't want to miss class.
You're kidding me. So no, he knows you're sitting on his house. He lures you away from his house. He knows he's a suspect, and he goes to class?
Well, he had to get to class. He would get in trouble.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. He would lose a grade if he wasn't there, you know, with the absenteeism.
And, of course, I skipped his going to the priest and confessing before
right.
he goes
well,
to class.
Well, you know, he's a good Catholic. So, anyway, so go ahead. So I assume you saw him in class and arrested him, please?
Yes.
Okay.
Very carefully, you know, very politely, we arrested him in the hall, walked him out. We did not Mirandize him. Because my theory of Miranda is until he is in custody, A, and being questioned, he doesn't have to be Mirandized. So I hold off Miranda until it's necessary.
Okay, I'm cringing. Go ahead.
What happened?
So I bring him into the jail, and I'm booking him in. He looks at me, and he hands me a card for an attorney. And he says, I have an appointment at 5 o'clock to meet with this attorney. And it's about 2 in the afternoon or 1:30. And I said, okay, well, you should be done processing by then. Should be okay. So he said, fine. So all he said was he had an appointment.
Right.
So you gave him the impression that he was free to leave, or he would be free to leave soon?
Yes.
Okay.
No questioning yet.
All right.
So... a little time goes by. We finish the processing. He again says, it's getting a little tight. I only got about 2 hours before that appointment. I said, well, no problem. We just want to talk to you for a few minutes. So he said, okay. At this point, again, being the young agent that I was now excluded from the interview.
Oh.
Because senior agents and police officers who were experts in interrogation we're now handling the interview.
All right. And then I assume they must have read him his Miranda rights?
Yes, he was Mirandized and began the interview, which was going on for about 2 hours into the interview, and James said nothing.
Were you observing the interview, or did you learn this later?
I observed. I was observing. I walked by the door of the interrogation room. I offered James a Coke. Because it was opened, they were taking a break, and James said to me, are you the one that wanted the pizza last night outside my house? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, I feel bad for not doing that. Let me confess to you.
Are you kidding me? This case gets crazier and crazier.
Okay, and so what did he confess to you?
He confessed to the little boy, the little girl, trying to kidnap the girl out of the vending machine area. He had sodomized the girl. He was into vampirism. He had tried drawing blood from her to drink. And again, the one key thing that behavioral science had said, there was a trigger. And I asked him that, what happened, James, in your life to make you want to do this? He said, my best friend, my dog died. And my dad wouldn't let me get another one.
Wow. Wow. Just.
Oh.
Wow.
So James was sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms.
Well, I have to say, Francie and I have been doing this a while. We've both been in law enforcement for decades and prosecutors, and I've been an investigator for, you know, over 22 years. John, I have never heard of a case quite like that. That was nail-biting.
That was
crazy. But it shows that tenacity and ingenuity and even having the balls to knock on a suspect's door
and ask for pizza.
I've just never heard of that technique as an interrogation technique, but clearly it was successful. Bravo, I just have to say.
Well, and I have to say that I hope we have John back as a guest a bunch of times, because I'm wondering whether he learned from this experience and got ever more bold and crazy in his techniques, or whether he calmed down. John, don't answer that now, but I hope to find out.
All right. Well, thank you so much, John, for coming on Best Case, Worst Case.
Well, thank you both very much for the opportunity to share some of my experiences.
Well, we'll have you back on again very shortly, but for now, we're signing off on Best Case, Worst Case. Thank you for listening.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production, produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA, engineered and edited by Terrell Parham, music by Simba Tsumba, and hosted by Wondery.
Thank you.